This is Dan Austin. This is a tape recording with Jim Ogle, the Yankee Alumni Association Director at Fort Lauderdale Yankee Stadium. The date is Friday, March 6, 1992. This is the property of the Baseball Hall of Fame for their archives. And Jim, thank you for accepting the invitation to interview you for the Hall of Fame. And so I'll just begin by saying that you created a novel institution in professional baseball by being, I guess, the first alumni director.
Yes, and it was Mr. Steinbrenner's idea, and I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and I was given the job of organizing it and running it. And
so you,
it has turned out very successful.
You approached him with the idea in
73? No, it was his idea.
It was his idea.
But when he broached the idea, I jumped it real fast.
And where did this occur? Just when he bought the Yankees in 73?
Sure, his first year, yes. We were in Arlington, Texas, with the ball club, and I was interviewing him on a totally unrelated subject. And I happened to come up during the interview, and that was really the seed that was planted that day.
Mm-hmm. And you jumped on and said, I'm ready to go.
I'm ready to go.
What were you doing with the Yankees before
I was traveling. I was a traveling sports writer. I was with the Newhouse organization, mm-hmm. based in Newark, New Jersey, and had traveled with the Yankees continuously since the Mets and Dodgers left New York. Well, it wasn't the Mets, it was the Giants and the
Giants,
Dodgers.
Okay, so in the late 50s
and,
then?
Yeah. And then I, through 75, and I covered spring training in 1976, and never went back to New York. Finally reached my goal of living in Florida.
Okay. So kind of two cherished dreams, living in Florida and becoming the alumni director.
Especially with the Yankees.
With the Yankees, you bet. Your colleague here, Dick Kress, said that if there's anybody who knows about baseball history, I'm talking to him right now. In that way, I'm not sure exactly where to begin, except to kind of say here's a free throw of free flow of ideas and events, because if anything, baseball is a collection of stories. Some of them are exaggerated. And so I just kind of started out as to what you would like to talk about, going back to the early years as a baseball writer, and I'll try to bring up some names or games or something like that that would have some kind of bearing on it. So I'm just going to throw it open, Jim.
Well, as a kid, baseball was a thrill to me, and I was smart enough to know I could never play it. So I figured that the closest I could get to it was to become a sports writer and cover baseball with my goal of covering the New York Yankees and traveling with them. Fortunately, I was able to attain that, and I spent many, many years writing, traveling with ball clubs, meeting people. And actually today, despite all the money these people make today, I feel sorry for them. Because they don't know the romance of baseball, they don't know the characters of baseball, and they don't know anything except the financial game from baseball. But mm-hmm. the characters that they didn't meet, the train rides they never took, they're all things that I think they would love if they had known about it. But I'm sure today if the traveling secretary said we're going to take a train, they'd file agreements with the Players Association to get back on the plane.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But traveling on a, especially on a World Series press train, was as big a thrill as anybody could ever have. It was so much fun. You could wander all over the train talking, telling stories and all this kind of stuff.
When was the first World Series press train ride that you had then?
1945, I believe it was.
It was the Chicago Cubs?
The Cubs and the Tigers.
Cubs and Tigers. Yeah. And so you were on the press train for Newhouse yes. Press Syndicate.
And from starting with that series, I covered 199 consecutive World Series games.
Okay, that would be
until 1975.
So 30 years.
Yeah.
So you saw really... up until the end of the reserve clause,
Yeah, I.
I was in.
You know, when this really started with Catfish Hunter,
mm-hmm.
and we were all in Oakland for the World Series in 74. Was it?
In 73, 70.
No, this was the. Let's see, he joined the. I think it was in 74.
Mm-hmm.
And out of nowhere, there's a press conference called, and Hunter announces that he is filing for breach of contract against Philly to become a free agent. And of course, this was an unheard of thing at that time. Everybody was astounded. And of course...
That he would have the gall to do that.
Yeah, you know, and especially a guy like Hunter, you know. But then the commissioner got into it. He put a deadline on what before anybody could make an offer to him and all that kind of stuff. Then I'm at the hotel in Miami on New Year's Eve covering the Orange Bowl game. And that was when it was announced that the Yankees had become the winners of the Catfish Hunter lottery. And then from then on, free agency and arbitration and all that stuff started to tear baseball apart as I knew it.
Yes. Turned it upside down.
Right.
Instead of dividing the profits among 26 baseball owners, it increased the pie to 600 plus.
For the players, yeah. And right now you wonder where it's all going to end. But the thing I miss mostly about baseball today is there's no character. When you think back of some of the people that you used to meet, talk to and deal with. You start with the Yankees, you know, Joe McCarthy, George Weiss, Ed Barrow, you know, people like that, mm-hmm. Jimmy Dykes, Casey Stengel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where do you find people like that today? Bill Beck. You know, it used to be a traveling baseball writer that never got tired traveling because every town you went into,
mm-hmm.
you know, there was somebody for you to talk to.
Well, why do you think that there were all those characters then and not today?
Because baseball men no longer run baseball.
It's business.
It's business. See, you know, who owns the ball clubs today? Some of them are owned by breweries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you had Colonel Rupert, and he was a sportsman. You had Tom Yorkey. Most of the people that ran ball clubs were that Stoneham family.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But now today, it's to me, it's much like the movies. Movies used to be made by movie people. Now they're made by banks and businessmen who only care about the bottom line. They don't care if it's a good movie,
mm-hmm.
as long as it made good money.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you don't see any good movies today.
Well, let's talk about some of those characters that you had the pleasure of interviewing, And in line with that, maybe there's some anecdotes that you recall about them that made them that special character. So I'll just start. Joe McCarthy.
Well, Joe McCarthy, the thing that always stands out to me is that even today, men who played with him call him Mr. McCarthy. Lefty Gomez, to the day he died, referred to him as Mr. McCarthy. Tommy Hendrick today calls him Mr. McCarthy. The respect that the players had for him. And he was, you know, he was, they swore, and from the stories they tell, I believe him, he had eyes in the back of his head. I mean, they had no idea he had seen them. Then the next day he'd say something like, "What were you doing down there last night?" And they had no idea how he found out. And of course, he's the guy that, he never sat in the lobby to check the players coming mm-hmm. in. He had a different system. He gave a bellboy a baseball. And he got autographs. And they knew what time the guys come in because the bellboy come on at midnight.
And the baseball players are kind of naive enough to say, "Oh, yeah, I'll
they never thought it was a draft." But and then Joe was a great psychologist. You know, he take like Joe Gordon when he first came up, he got off badly. But Joe put him on the bench for maybe 10 days, and when Joe came back, he was ready to play in the major league.
Mm-hmm. So you really knew the attitudes that were squirreled away in the guys' minds.
Oh, yeah. And he was a great guy. You know, he had stories. And the players just loved him. Although he was stern and took no nonsense. I could tell a story, Jake Powell joined the Yankees. And they were standing at a railroad station waiting for the train. And Jake gives one of the other guys a hot foot.
Mm-hmm.
Later on that day, McCarthy just called him on and said, Yankees don't do that. So that was
the message.
That was the way he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell the story when he first walked in the Yankee clubhouse, there's this table in the middle of the clubhouse. He said, what's that? Well, he said, that's where the guys play cards. He says, take it out of here and break it up. So he was very all baseball.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, strangely enough, the guy we got managing today is all baseball. Buck Showalter. He's a throwback to the old school.
About the old school.
All he thinks about is baseball.
But you got to handle ball players differently today.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, like John McGraw couldn't exist in today's world.
They would chew him up and bite him and spit him out in little pieces.
Well, you know, there's been stories over the last couple of years, like ball players got rid of managers.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, Dick Williams, remember when he,
yeah.
he was with the Red Sox, and he was a tough guy.
Yeah.
With a very sarcastic tongue.
Mm-hmm.
They won the pennant, but they got rid of him.
Yeah. Well, they did, but the Yankees did the same thing to Joe McCarthy.
No, Joe McCarthy, there were other reasons in there, which today would make big headlines, but then the writers of that day did not talk about it.
Didn't write about
that.
Things like
write
that.
About that. No, that was off the field. See, it used to be when you walked out of the ballpark, you weren't working, and the players knew that. You could fraternize with them, and they didn't worry about you, and you didn't worry about them, because they knew that this wasn't going to be in the paper.
But today it's fair game.
Today you're fair game, no matter where you are.
Which leads me, you started out as a sports writer, and you just illustrated a point about the different style of writing and what is fair game, which means that a lot of the comments that come out of baseball managers' and players' mouths, by and large, is kind of colorless. It's, hey, we're going to work hard. We're only going to be thinking about the next game.
Oh, well, that kind of stuff.
Because of...
That kind of stuff used to get printed today. It doesn't. It got to, you know, you could... it's strange. See, a morning paper never went down in the clubhouse after the game. When the game was over, you wrote your story.
Mm-hmm.
The afternoon paper, you had men who had been in baseball for many years, and they interpreted the game as they saw it. But then TV came along, and now the fans could see the game. Well, now you have to do something. You can't just tell how the game was played. So the afternoon papers started out going down to the clubhouse, talking to the star of the day and interviewing him, and that became the story. Then the morning guys, with television on so much, they had to do something to protect themselves. So they started going down for the interviews. So now everything, the game ends, and everybody flocks into the clubhouse for interviews. And they're all fighting each other to who can get the
big headline.
It used
big
to
quote.
Be like you had men like Dan Daniel
mm-hmm.
and John Grebinger and people like that, and they could just, they interpreted the game as they saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Today, they interview people and talk to them. And it gets to the point where one year you talk to a pitcher, I lost my concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Another year I was hitting the black. Another year you talk to a batter, I was just an eighth of an inch under the ball. It got to more or less rope. You knew what they were going to say before you asked
them.
Mm-hmm. And of course they started hiding in the trainer's room. You couldn't really get it. But the whole thing changed.
When you started out in baseball writing, I imagine you had a couple of people that you idolized in sports journalism that you kind of said, I'm going to pattern myself after those guys.
No, I don't know that so much, but I always enjoyed reading Daniel.
Okay.
And always enjoyed reading Drebinger because they wrote baseball all the time. Now, actually, I think I was the last of the day one, the finale, to cover baseball. I didn't miss a day. From a week before the before spring training. About a week after the World Series, I was in the paper every day. I never missed a ball game. I covered every ball game of the season. Now you don't get that. Now with unions and wives that don't let you be away that long, they don't, you know, now they switch off all the time. They don't have anybody
that travels with the team.
No.
So they get really a chance to know what's affecting a ball
you
player.
You got continuity. I had a continuity. I didn't miss anything. Another change was when I traveled to ball club, each writer had his own books. You had a pitching book, you had a batting book. And if you wanted to look something up, you looked at your own book. You didn't have to call up the club media relations man and say, hey, what happened on this day? Now you walk into a press box and they hand you a sheaf of notes. Now, if you read all the notes, you wouldn't be able to watch the game.
That's right.
It used to be you get notes, maybe 8 or 9 notes, which were valuable because they were updated.
Uh-huh.
But as far as stats were concerned, we had our own. We didn't.
You kept your own?
Yeah.
And you set up your own system?
Yeah.
Okay, let's take the year 1949. You were, at that time, traveling with the Yankees?
No, I wasn't traveling them then.
Okay.
I was, you know, we used to cover whichever team in New York was at home.
Okay.
And if the Yankees at home, we covered the Yankees, the Giants
and
the
Dodgers.
And so the paper didn't get into full-time covering until...
So you had your own
later.
Byline?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And, but let's say... Okay, in the late 50s, late 40s, you would watch the teams, any one of the three teams, when they came home.
We started going to spring training maybe around that time.
Uh-huh.
And the year that the Yankees and Giants switched camps, how did that work? It was the year after the Giants beat the Indians in the World Series.
That would have been 54?
Yeah. I went to Arizona with the Giants instead of mm-hmm. with the Yankees. And so that was, you know, now you got a whole new group of characters. You had Horace Stone, and you had Neil DeRocher.
Mm-hmm.
Willie Mays was a youngster at that time. And Mickey Grasso was the reserve catcher. He was one of the RAs of the team. I was always blowing his sack. So there was a day, when you're training in Arizona, you travel to play. You know. So this day they sent him with a B team to play someplace. First inning, he gets thrown out of the game.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have any other catcher. And that was my first airplane ride was that year, too. Flew from Phoenix to Vegas on Bonanza Airlines. Then that night we flew into L.A. Mm-hmm. And flying into L.A. with a spread all over, it was quite a thrill.
Mm-hmm.
And then Leo, of course, was always big with the Hollywood people. And he always had a party at his home when the team played in Hollywood. And that was quite a night, meeting a lot of these movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would say the most memorable thing was being in a little room with Johnny Mercer playing the piano and Doris Day singing.
You probably scratched your head and said, I don't believe this is happening.
That's right, yeah. Gary Cooper came in and Sid Cerise came in. It was just a very memorable evening.
Okay. Of course, Leo, earlier in the 40s, when he married Lorraine Day, he got kind of the hot water, didn't he, with a baseball commissioner?
It happened something about he had some gambler sat in his box,
right,
or something like that.
Yeah.
Leo was always, but there's another one of your great characters.
Yes, he was.
Being around Leo was a thrill a minute, you know. He said what he thought, and he was very entertaining, very exciting to be around. I remember I interviewed Lorraine Day one time for a story. She was very nice. because she had a post-game show or something.
Uh-huh. That's right.
Then, you know, with the Giants, you met people like Dusty Rhodes,
mm-hmm.
Wes Westland, and Eddie Brannick was one of the all-time great traveling secretaries.
Mm-hmm.
And you always were running into people. Always somebody to talk to, somebody interesting.
Leo Durocher, you know, he just passed away this
yes.
About 6 months ago, and of course the writer said he should have been in the Hall of Fame.
Sure, he should.
And
I don't know why, because, you know, despite all the controversy and everything, he was popular. I mean, he was a great story any time you talked to him. He never went away empty-handed.
Never went away. Well, a couple of great stories you recall that talking with one of the premier, well, hustlers, there's no doubt about it, when he went down to second base, I don't care how big you were, he was going to come in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, the thing I remember most about him is when Bobby Thompson hit the home run, and he and Eddie Stanky collided on the third baseline, you know, rolled on the ground in each other's arms, and said, Giants were independent, you know, that kind of stuff.
You witnessed that game?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've had some memories, like I saw that game. I saw the Don Larson's perfect game.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the Carlton Fisk home run in Boston. And,
going back to, you know, some of these memorable games, Bobby Thompson, you know, those games have been recreated on newsreel many times, but let's take the Bobby Thompson home run that the Giants won the play of that playoff game there. Is there something in the writing and the telling of that game that you found missing that you would add for the record? Or has it been pretty well described?
I don't think, because at that time, you're right with it. You're not going to miss anything.
Mm-hmm. But the strategy of how Thompson came up to bat, wasn't that... I think it was a pinch hitter or a pinch runner beforehand, and there was
there was a pinch runner because the runner slid in the third base and injured his ankle, and they had to take him out. That had nothing to do with the batter.
Okay.
Then they switched pitches, of course. They took Newcomb out and brought in Branca. And poor Branca, he made a bad pitch and became famous.
Right.
But in the polo grounds with those short seats,
mm-hmm.
anything could happen.
That's right.
Like the, and of course, you got the game when Willie Mays made the catch on Vic Wirtz in center field.
Mm-hmm.
And that same series had Dusty Rhodes. Every time he stuck his nose out of the dugout, he did something. He hit a home run, or he drove in the head, he did a pinch hit.
Yeah.
And at that time, Willie Mays was he was really something because he was so bubbly. And
mm-hmm. The train rides. Let's go back to your first World Series, 1945. Detroit Tigers and Chicago Cubs.
Yeah.
You had Phil Cavaretta, I think, played for the Cubs.
See, we traveled, the riders traveled on a press train.
You didn't ride with the players?
They didn't ride with the players, had their own trains.
Oh.
But the riders traveled, and officials and umpires and things like that. The thing I remember mostly about a train was in the World Series between the Cardinals and the Braves.
What year was that? 46?
Somewhere. In,
okay.
It was the first. That was the longest trip you could make in baseball at that time.
Between Boston and St. Louis.
Yeah.
And you made it.
And you made it. Yeah, and you made it by... by train.
Mm-hmm.
And if a series went seven games, there was a day off before the seventh game for them to sell tickets. They
uh-huh.
didn't sell them like they do now.
Yeah.
So,
well, that was a good day and a half ride on train, wasn't it?
That was about 24 hours. That was 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was actually the first playoff. Now, the Dodgers and the Cardinals tied, and they had a 2 out of 3 playoff,
mm-hmm.
which opened in St. Louis, and the Cardinals won.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the next day, I went to the ballpark with my luggage and everything else. I didn't get home for 17 days because the Cardinals won again. Mm-hmm. So now you go right into the World Series. And you got to go to St. Louis, you got to go to Boston. And that was the series when Slaughter scored the winning run, and there was the debate about whether or not Pesky held the ball too long.
That's right.
And of course, the whole talk on the train going back was that Mike Gonzalez, who was the third base coach, tell Slaughter, go, 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 and no, no, no.
No. That's right. That's when he scored from first base on that single or something.
Mm-hmm.
Replayed countless times, but
Slaughter today, you know, he still hasn't changed. You know, he's 73. He's still playing all the time.
Yeah,
you know, which is and.
No, you don't change that kind of guy. When he'd probably still go out there and run the bases for all he's worth.
Yeah, sure.
You saw some not only characters but some fantastic heroes of baseball history.
Oh yeah.
You know, you talk about the Cardinals. Indeed, Stan Musial comes to mind. Red Shandies, who's still with the Cardinals. For the record, you have some thoughts about them. You said they're characters, and I was trying to dwell into that.
Well, no, they weren't like Shandies. The thing I remember about him, he was a operetta buff. You know, he used to be a fan of the St. Louis Municipal Opera, which I always wanted to attend. And since I was in the American League, they didn't until they played the All-Star game in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So I took advantage of that. I saw the closing night of one show and the opening night of the other while I was there for the All-Star game. Mm-hmm. Musial was just talent in anything he touched, like San Luis DiMaggio. You know,
you just knew it when they walked in the ballpark.
Oh yeah,
that there was talent.
Yeah, like, I had many arguments with people about who's better, DiMaggio or Mays.
Mm-hmm.
I had DiMaggio stand in front of balls that Mays makes six catches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But Willie was a very exciting ball player. No matter whether it was a bat in the field on the bases, he could beat them in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Joe did the same, except he did it in a classier way, very smooth. He was the epitome of class. He was the epitome of a Yankee. And then DiMaggio, Mantle, I always thought if he had legs, would have made him forget everybody. Because he had the speed to go with his power.
Yeah, speed?
The things I saw Mickey do. No, you see Mickey get ready to play a ball game, you wonder how he can walk.
What was the scene? Recreate that scene when they were getting ready to put him out there in the ball field.
Well, he'd have to get his legs bandied. Like, the thing that showed up was at an All-Star game, when all the players from all the teams are in the same clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the players on the other teams would watch Mickey get ready to play. They would just shake their heads in amazement. How can he play the way he does? I think he had the highest pain threshold of anybody I've ever met. I would see Mickey get under it twice at the hotel.
Morning.
And he looked like your grandmother getting on the bus and getting off the bus. The ninth inning, he'd steal second base to win the ball game and get back on the bus looking like your grandmother. But for that moment, he went from first to second. He was amazing. Some of the balls he hit, Mickey would be out 6 weeks. They come back, they send him up to Sunday afternoon in New York, we're playing a doubleheader. We already lost the first game, now we're losing the second game. And it's a dark, dreary day.
Mm-hmm.
And now they send Mickey up to pitch. I think George Brunette was the pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And he hits one out, ties the game, the Yankees win the next game. Well, that you don't forget, though. He did the same thing in Cleveland. He was out 5 or 6 weeks. Come back, hit a home run. Unfortunately, the relief pitcher blew the ball game that Mickey had. But he got hurt in Baltimore. They have a wire fence. He went back for a ball, had his foot caught in the wire fence, put him in the hospital. I said, gee, Doc, that don't look too bad. Maybe you bandaged it tightly. But baseball players don't do that. Another guy that's always been mistreated was that Roger Maris. Roger Maris is a much better ball player than anybody ever came across. He was an outstanding outfielder.
Mm-hmm.
He was an outstanding baseballer. Nobody could break up a double play, but he had the arm, he had, but, you know, he didn't have the personality. Everybody, you know, he was, but if you asked Roger a question, he gave you an answer. You didn't like it, tough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that, of course, when he was on the threshold of breaking Babe Ruth's record, I think a lot of people were very jealous and didn't want him to do it.
That's right.
They did not want him to be successful.
I'll never forget the night in Baltimore. He was playing the 154th game. And there was an air about the ballpark that was eerie. Anybody was afraid to talk to him and say to him or anything like that. And then he did hit a home run. He came very, very close to tying with that run.
Mm-hmm.
He did get the 159, the 59th. And he came awfully close to getting the 60th, but he didn't. But by that time, Roger was a basket case. It was just...
I heard that his hair almost turned gray that year.
Well, no, his hair started falling out.
Yeah.
In clumps. And, but Roger was a great guy.
And
of course...
But he became a lonely man after that.
You know, Roger was the kind of guy, if you were his friend, you were his friend.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to, any part of you, he had no part of you. He was a one-way guy. He never changed mm-hmm. from the day I first met him.
Mm-hmm.
First day he ever joined the Yankees was in St. Petersburg.
That's when he was traded by the Kansas City A's in 58 for Hank Bauer and a few others.
Yeah, he reported in, no, it wasn't 58, it was 61 was his, 60 was his first year with the Yankees.
Okay.
And, naturally, everybody interviewed him his first day report, mm-hmm. and they said, Roger, how many home runs do you think you're going to hit in the stadium with that short porch?
Yeah.
Oh, he's a 20-25. They said, what? 20-25? He said, look, if I said 40 and hit 30, I'd have a bad year.
Uh-huh.
If I say 25 and hit 35, I had a good year.
Yeah.
So that was Roger.
Yeah.
Never changed, never deviated.
Mm-hmm.
Because you talk about Stengel, that's the number one character of all time.
Yes, there's no doubt about it.
I mean, Casey Stengel was the greatest salesman baseball ever had.
Even more so than Satchel Paige and...
Casey was, to me, Casey was...
Lefty Gomez and Babe Ruth and... I mean, that's a mighty heady statement.
Yeah, but Stengel sold baseball... Like, when he got joined the Mets, nobody ever wrote about how lousy the Mets were that year. They all wrote about Stengel.
Uh-huh.
So that's protected the players,
mm-hmm.
and people knew him everywhere. Now, I'm not knocking down Gomez. Now, Lefty Gomez made hundreds of appearances, never got a dime.
Mm-hmm.
He did it for baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Ruth saved baseball
mm-hmm.
after the Black Sox.
Yeah.
But for a long period of time, and for more people, everybody knew Casey. He's a guy who sit in the middle of the hotel lobby. Now people walk up, he talked to anybody. I remember one day a lady walks up to him, she got a card. It's Santa Claus with Casey's head on it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, geez, I didn't think anybody but Edna, his wife,
uh-huh.
thought I was Santa Claus. Another day a guy walks up, he was in dental school.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to see my office? Yeah. So this is Casey. I mean, he was always ready to talk.
Never met a stranger.
Never met a stranger.
When the Yankees hired him in 49, they had fired Harris. The team was then owned by Topling and Del Webb, and I think. But anyway, and I heard a story that a lot of people thought, well, hey, this is not the stuff of the Yankee tradition. This is not the tradition of Joe DiMaggio and what he stood for, and here comes this clown.
That's what they said. They said the Yankees hired the clown, because that was what he had been. You know, all like was all kinds of stories about him. Like the one in the, when he was managing the Braves, he got hit with a cab, broke his leg. And one of the writers in Boston at the end of the year nominated the cab driver as the man who did most for baseball in Boston.
God.
And then, of course, you know, he went out on, it was raining, the umpire didn't call a game, he went out with an umbrella. And the game in Brooklyn, he took off his hat and the bird flew out. So, you know, Casey was that kind of guy. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about, when you want to know about baseball, man, was anybody doing more baseball than Casey Stengel?
So, really, when the players got to know him, they got beyond the entertainment part and the birds out of the hat, and here was a guy that really knew.
Oh, sure. You know, like, he was a great platooner. And he used to platoon Woodling and Bauer,
mm-hmm.
both of whom are hot-headed guys, and they were always moaning and bitching about it. But after their careers were over, they admitted he was right, that he had extended both of their careers by platooning
them. And really, the platooning system, I guess, well, in part, maybe Branch Rickey with the Dodgers, and Stengel picked up on that. And
Stengel started.
You really think he was the pioneer?
No,
he was the instigator?
They didn't platoon. You played, no matter, same as football. It used to be two-way football players. Now you're a specialist. All you have to do is agree when there's a kickoff. That's your whole job. You're the defensive team for the kickoff.
They get much notice among the press of that kind of major change, shift, in when Stengel set up the platoon system?
Oh, yeah, it was a lot.
Was there a lot of discussion about that?
A lot of talk about platoon.
What does some of the sports writers say about it? They ridicule it?
No, they just wrote facts.
Wrote the facts?
Yeah.
They didn't try to speculate, saying this is bad for baseball or anything like that?
His first year, he came out of nowhere, and the Yankees were in the Ebbets Field to play exhibition games. He used to play exhibition games at the end of it. And Stengel took Mickey out, taught him how to play the wall in Ebbets Field.
At Ebbets Field.
Yeah. And Mickey says, gee, did you play here? Stengel says, gee, the kid thought I was bored. I said, then, of course, you know, like 1923, when the Yankees won their first World Series, Stengel was the only guy that heard him, and he did a couple inside the park home runs. The woman, Edna, who was going to become his wife, had just become his wife, was at the game with her father. And he walked around the bases by the time he got to home plate, inside the park home run. He was in a state of collapse. The father turned to her and said, my God, you married an old man. In case he was never old.
No, he was just young in spirit all of his life.
Oh, yeah. The night we won the pennant in Boston, clinched the pennant in Boston, and they had a little party before.
This was, what, 49?
No, it wasn't 49.
Okay.
I don't know what it was, but it wasn't 49. And we clinched the pennant in Boston, and now we get on the train to go to Washington. Casey sat in the back seat. One of the cards. And as each player went by him to go to bed, he'd stop him and say a little something to him, thank him for helping and all that kind of stuff. Now I left, it was 2:30 in the morning, I guess, in case he's still sick. I would get into Washington, get off the train, it's about 6:30, 6:45. The only guy who looked like he had a great night's sleep was Casey. He was bouncing along, everybody else was dragging.
Thank
but he's bouncing along. I've been to bed since 8:00 the night before. He probably never went to bed.
But that kind of feeling, contagious.
It was only one case.
Did he feel betrayed when the Yankees released him, 1960?
Well,
and of course, Weiss was also released as GM at that time.
At the press conference. See, what had happened, now Casey was getting up in years. There was a lot of stories about he'd fall asleep on the bench. But actually, they had Houck coming up. And a lot of ball clubs were interested in him. The Yankee, he wasn't going to be the Yankee manager. He was going to get offers from other people. The Yankees felt that it's time they had to make a move if they wanted to retain the house. So, as I understand it, it was all worked out. You know, Stengel had agreed and everything. And now we have this big press conference. And Casey, of course, was always the consummate actor. And he saw this big audience and went away from the script. And instead of bowing out gracefully, attacked. I was fired, the wall, and all this kind of stuff, which created a big hoopla. And then Weiss went a few days later. One of the most brilliant men ever in baseball.
George Weiss.
Now George would make these deals, and everything would be all settled, and then he'd say, well, maybe we ought to get a little, how about that little guy you got and such and such? Well, that little guy is such and such turned out to be the best thing you got in the deal. He had a guy like Eddie Miller, Vince DiMaggio, first baby named Zero. He made more money off those guys. He'd get them and trade them. And that's why the Yankee farm system was always the greatest. Look, they had two AAA ball clubs.
Yes.
And they played each other in the Junior World Series.
That's right.
Well, that's a lot of good ballplayers.
You better believe it is. I mean, you know that you won the World Series and Little World Series.
And don't forget, you only had 16 ball clubs at that time.
That's right.
So there was a lot of ball players around, but most of them were Yankees. In Kansas City or in Newark.
Well, of course, Hank Greenberg, when he was general manager for the Tigers in the mid-50s when Arnold Johnson owned the Kansas City Athletics, he said, you know, you got to win because you even got a farm team in the major leagues. But that doesn't take away from the Yankee tradition in any stretch of the imagination.
Then, you know, you had great, they had the best scouts.
Yes.
Like Paul Critchell, another great character. Now, see, today, it wouldn't make any difference if you could have Paul Critchell here today. It doesn't do you any good.
No.
Because you got to go on your turn. So if no matter who he found, you couldn't get him. Unless it was your turn and he was still free.
Okay.
But Critchell, Joe Devine, Don Essick, those guys, you know, they were great scouts.
George Weiss, a shrewd baseball mind. I have read recently where, and it may be unfounded, that if he could keep the Yankees' salary schedule or salaries below the 800,000 mark or whatever figure it was, that he could get a percentage of whatever he could keep the salary. Yeah, it's almost like a slave labor.
No, I don't know anything about that. But naturally, in those days, they had Barrow before Weiss. Naturally, their idea was to keep salaries as low as they could.
Yeah.
But don't forget, you could see a ball game for half a buck.
Yes.
You could get a reserve seat for $1.50 or a buck.
And no TV revenues.
That's right. So, I mean, it was a whole different ball game. You didn't draw a million people in those days.
You didn't? Then was that unusual to draw?
Well, the millions came later, but you didn't draw a million people in those days. So naturally, and of course, you know, like Babe Ruth's $80,000.
Yes.
Today, what would that be worth in today's money? So it was not unusual. Everybody got that one. You know, Lefty Gomez 1 year sent his contract back and said, "Dear Ed, I think you made a mistake. This is the Bat Boys contract, isn't it?" So, and if you didn't do well, you got cut. And these long, you never got. See, you it used to be you got paid the upcoming year for what you did last year.
That's right.
And you got a 1 year contract. And if you got more than that, it was very unusual. Johnny Mize said one time, he signed a 2-year contract. And he said, it affected me. He said, I didn't have as good a year as I should have.
Didn't play as hungry?
He only hit 3-something and with about 35 homers. That wasn't a good year for him. But see, this is the whole, you know, today they get $1 million and they hit 210. They don't care.
That's right.
They got the money.
Yeah. or they're mortgaging the future. Let's put it that way.
So that's a whole different. Well, you get into salaries, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah. Before we, you're looking up through, I guess, something, a booklet that reminds you of something,
no,
or
I'm
the attendance?
Like, yeah. In 1903, the total attendance was 211,000.
Hmm.
1945, it was 881,000. See, then all of a sudden it broke into the millions.
It was really after the World War II that you got into the million-dollar attendance records. Up to today, I think Toronto, I guess, has the...
4 million. Yeah,
4 million.
Yeah.
Before we turn this on... we were talking about characters, and I told you I got a phone call from Sports Illustrated asking me if I knew Mo Berg. And I said, no, never heard of him, and you kind of arched your eyebrows. I don't know how much interest there is in Mo Berg, but you certainly said, hey, this is one of baseball's outstanding characters.
Well, I think most people would be like you. Who's Mo Berg?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he always, like somebody thought he was one of the Three Stooges. But Mo was, he lived in New Jersey, he lived around New York, he was a Princeton graduate, among other universities, and he always, he was a big, heavy-set man with real dark black hair, dark black eyebrows, always wore black, like a spy, which he was, you know. As all, you know, he never talked about it, though. You could never get Mo to break down and admit what he had done.
This is side two of tape number one with Jim Ogle. So Mo Berg was a catcher.
He had the talent
as a baseball player.
He was a very smart catcher and a very smart handler of a pitcher, but he couldn't hit. So maybe that's why he went into the spy. You don't have to hit there.
For the U.S. government.
Yeah. But those stories, you know, that was always a mystery. We always called
Was this kind of well-known, or this is after he died?
Well, around New Jersey he was well-known.
I mean, the fact that he was a spy?
Oh, yeah. I rode back and forth with him to the ballpark many times, you know. We always call him Mysterious Mo Berg, but you can never get him to tell any stories about what he had done. But he was a very, very strange kind of a guy, a real nice guy,
mm-hmm.
you know. But he was always mysterious.